Hey, welcome. Welcome, everybody. Good morning. My name is Dave Lambert. I'm the convener for this morning's fellowship meeting. I have to thank Marissa Larson. I don't know where Marissa is at the moment, but she suggested the music for this morning. I also appreciate the help that Sandy Nelson continues to give to the fellowship, but especially stepping up to lead the children's story this morning, as well as to Dave Colburn, our speaker for this morning. Thank you, Dave, for coming. The hot, hot days of July are at least temporarily behind us, with today's rain and a few days of more moderate temperatures. So I encourage everybody to enjoy these mild days, cooler days, either with a bike ride, a walk, working in the garden, or just drinking iced tea outdoors. Enjoy the nice weather, because we are part of the interconnected web of nature. So the next order of business is to light the chalice. You want to light the chalice. The chalice in its lighting is a symbol of what brings us together as a fellowship. The chalice and its flame draw upon Greek, Indian, Hebrew, Christian, and other traditions, and came to symbolize many things to you use, including hope and sacrifice. So we light this morning's chalice to symbolize hope and the many daily sacrifices of people of conscience. Okay, so we'll imagine that the chalice is lit, and we do have a lit candle anyway. So in the spirit of hope, please join us as we sing our first hymn, number 346 in the Gray Hymnal. I bring your attention to the announcements in the back of our program, and in addition, Molly will be giving a special announcement this morning.
So, Lily's going to start us off. We're not super coordinated, but start us off, Lily.
The outgoing chair, Kathleen Tenona, and new chair, Katie Kingery Page, have entrusted the teen group to create a notebook to help the new minister get to know us. A few weeks ago, we brainstormed and decided to call it Who's Who at the UU. We will need each member and a friend to provide us with information. Each person, adults and kids, will have a page. Reverend Johnstone will have a rich resource that goes well beyond a simple directory and its information. Compiling such a notebook is a recommended practice in ministerial transition.
This will be...
I'm not tall.
This will be a resource for the new minister, but it will also be a way for our youth to better know our membership, connect with the new minister, and some alternative summer programming.
Thank you, McKaylee.
You're welcome.
You'll grow, maybe. After today, we'll send an email and make a Facebook post to make sure members that aren't here are aware of the project. We have sample pages that I just showed around really quickly, but as soon as the service is over today, we'll come back in with those sample pages, and we have some survey forms if anyone's willing to fill it out right now, so I can talk to people in a little more depth, and you can see the examples right after service today. And we'll be taking pictures that, if you're happy with them, we can use as part of your profile, and we're going to take the frame back with us today to take pictures of kids as well. So we have an adult survey, a youth survey, and a child survey. And Nick, for example, who's kind of between child and youth, did a kind of a blend of the two. It's not fixed. We want you to share what you're comfortable sharing, but we do think that it will be something that will be very helpful to Reverend Johnstone, and so we would appreciate as much participation as we can get. And we have about 4 weeks, 5 weeks until she's here, so we've got some time to do it. So I'll be back up here at the end of service. And Lily, did you want to say the last part?
And after you get your picture taken, today is Ice Cream Day. So the RE program has ice cream for everyone and sprinkles and chocolate chips. So after you get your picture taken, that can be your key to go get ice cream. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I would suggest do it. So now is the time that we share with those in the fellowship any joys and concerns that might be affecting your lives. So Doug will rotate with the microphone.
Hello. Matt's back in the nursery with Cade, but... We welcome June on July 8th, so she's in her 11th day of life right now. So, hello to everyone from June.
Kleina Stanton, I just want to say that Stuart and I are taking off this week to go first to Idaho to see my dad, who's 98, and then up to Bozeman, Montana for the month of August to be with our kids and maybe do some camping and hiking. So we'll see you guys again in September. And they're getting a new minister, so we get to see their new minister before we see our new minister.
Hi, Sarah Lott. I have a joy that I'm going to be moving on to Vermont, but it's also, of course, a concern because this fellowship has been a home for Alex and I for a couple years now, and I'm really, really sad to be leaving you all, and can't wait until we get a chance to come back and visit and see the new minister. We're really, really excited for you all, so look forward to seeing what happens.
Sandy Nelson, and my joy is that this microphone's about to get passed to the Bachman family, and we're so happy that they're here today visiting.
Hello, Bachman family. Just happened to be driving down the road, and good timing. Hey, let's stop in and see the old UU again. And good to be back for a Sunday.
Welcome.
Ken Embers, I have joy and concern. My wife, Pat, is in upstate New York. She's been there for about a week, and she's participating in a Native American Sundance ceremony. So she's going through, hopefully joyfully, 4 days of fasting, singing, and chanting with the Native American elders there. And she'll be back next Saturday.
Gene Severs. I think Jessica got back from Wisconsin last night. My concern is Michaela driving the truck and stock trailer rig back from her ventures in Oregon that some of you have seen on Facebook. And my joy is that she's almost halfway back, driving by herself.
Others? Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate, and we all appreciate, the joys and concerns that you've felt free to express. Sandy, come on down. I beat you to it.
There used to be a game show? Who does that?
Price is Right.
Not that I ever watched.
We're live. So today's speaker, anybody know who today's speaker for the adults is? Man, Lily. Today's speaker is my husband, Lily's dad. And one of the things he used to do when our kids were really little, no, not really little, about your age, maybe a little older, maybe a little younger. One of the things he used to do was volunteer in schools, specifically the schools that our kids went to, because he thought that was a really important thing to do, to share. And he would read to their classes. And one of his favorite things to read was a book called Where the Sidewalk Ends by Shel Silverstein. Does anybody know that book? Do you know that book? Do you guys know that book? So what he would do, he would say, give me a number between, I don't know, page. Man, these aren't numbered. How do you figure that out? No, they're not. Oh, some of them are. Okay. From page 9 to page, oh, say, 150 or so. And I'll read that poem. So this is what he did, and it's fun, so we're going to do that today. Do you remember your number, Lily? 72, said Lily, without any prompting. But I think she meant 71. Okay, we'll read 72 first, and maybe 71 will be mentioned later. This one is Drats. Can anyone lend me 2 80-pound rats? I want to rid my house of cats. That's the one you wanted? Oh, because the book, and the reason she picked that one is because our cat Milo decided he wanted the book this morning. Okay, give me a number, somebody. What page should I read?
21.
It's dark in here. I'm writing. I'm not going to use that. It's dark in here. I'm writing these poems from inside a lion. And it's rather dark in here. So please excuse the handwriting, which may not be too clear. But this afternoon by the lion's cage, I'm afraid I got too near, and I'm writing these lines from inside a lion, and it's rather dark in here. 64. Where the sidewalk ends. There is a place, there's no picture, sorry. There is a place where the sidewalk ends and before the street begins, and the grass grows soft and white, and there the sun burns crimson bright, and there the moonbird rests from his flight to cool in the peppermint wind. Let us leave this place where the smoke blows black and the dark street winds and bends, past the pits where the asphalt flowers grow. We shall walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and watch where the chalk-white arrows go, to the place where the sidewalk ends. Yes, we'll walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and we'll go where the chalk-white arrows go, for the children they mark, and the children they know, the place where the sidewalk ends. Ryder, you got one?
Yeah,
30. 30. Early bird. Oh, if you're a bird, be an early bird and catch the worm for your breakfast plate. If you're a bird, be an early bird. But if you're a worm, sleep late. That was a good one. 70. 66. 69, 70. That's a long one. Sarah, Cynthia, Sylvia, Stout would not take the garbage out. She'd scour the pots and scrape the pans, candy the yams and spice the hams, and through, and though her daddy would scream and shout, she simply would not take the garbage out. And so it piled up to the ceilings. Coffee grounds and potato peelings, brown bananas, rotten peas, chunks of sour cottage cheese. It filled the can, it covered the floor. It cracked the window, it blocked the door. With bacon rinds and chicken bones, drippy ends of ice cream cones, prune pits, peach pits, orange peel, gloppy glumps of cold oatmeal, pizza crusts and withered greens, soggy beans and tangerines, crusts of black burned buttered toast, grisly bits of beefy roasts. The garbage rolled on down the hall. It raised the roof. It broke the wall. Greasy napkins, cookie crumbs, globs of gooey bubble gum, cellophane from green bologna, rubbery, blubbery macaroni, peanut butter caked and dry, curdled milk and crusts of pie, moldy melons, dried up mustard, eggshells mixed with lemon custard, cold French fries and rancid meat, yellow lumps of cream of wheat. At last the garbage reached so high that finally it touched the sky, and all the neighbors moved away, and none of her friends would come to play. And finally Sarah Cynthia Stout said, "Okay, I'll take the garbage out." But then, of course, it was too late. The garbage reached across the state from New York to the Golden Gate. And there in the garbage she did hate, poor Sarah met an awful fate. Because the, oh, that I cannot right now relate, because the hour is much too late. But children, remember Sarah Stout, and always take the garbage out. Okay, that's okay. Arthur, one more. What number? 31, and then we'll go. 31. Sky seasoning. A piece of sky broke off and fell through the crack in the ceiling right into my soup, kerplop. I really must state that I usually hate lentil soup, but I ate every drop. Delicious, delicious. A bit like plaster, but so delicious, goodness sake, I could have eaten a lentil soup lake. It's amazing the difference a bit of sky can make. That was fun. So we'll go back and do some more. Okay?
Oh, and love, our hearts go with you.
This morning's offerings will go to support the fellowship and all that it does. Thank you, Renee. In 1988, Robert Fulghum published a book of his essays, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. In this small book, Robert offers the wisdom that has guided him about how to live and what to do and how to be. Lessons that he learned include share everything, play fair, don't hit people, and clean up your own mess, among many other lessons described in the book. However, fulfilling playing fair might be, we would not be enjoying the wondrous photos from the spacecraft New Horizons as it made its journey past Pluto this past week if we had stopped learning in kindergarten. Stephen Hawking wrote in a congratulatory email to the New Horizons team, we explore because we are human, and we want to know. Public education is under threat. As one who reads the front page stories this week in the local newspaper knows. Although these trials result from reduced state budgets, the reduced budgets themselves might reflect purposeful attempts by a group of public education reformers as part of a conspiracy to undermine what was once considered the world's leading educational system. As Catherine Smith wrote in her 2012 book, listening to the debates about public schools, one hears plenty of opposing opinions. Some want to change the schools. Others want to leave them. But the smart money seems to know what it is doing. It provides support for programs, which she describes in her book, which slowly erode the support for public education in the country at large and in their own constituency in particular. And then the groundwork is laid for dismantling public education in favor of a private system of education funded by the state. We are fortunate this morning to have Dave Colburn, who's a long-time serving member of the Manhattan-Ogden School District, speaking to the values of public education and the challenges that they currently face. His comments, I hope, will range from the philosophical to the minute detail necessary in developing an annual budget for the district. So please welcome Dave.
Good morning. I think most of you know me, and I know most of you. I've been bopping in and out of here for over 30 years. Sandy, obviously, my wife, has been active in the church for a long time, the fellowship. And I greatly appreciate the role that this institution and all of you individuals have played in my daughter's lives. So I've got three wonderful daughters, and part of our success as parents has been what this fellowship has done to help nurture their souls and their spirits and their intellects, and I greatly appreciate that. A few months ago, Sandy said that the fellowship was looking for programming, and I stepped up to the challenge because I'm passionate about public education, and I'm very, very concerned about where we're headed in this state and in this country. And I think probably most of you know about that, but I wanted to talk about it in case you didn't understand some of the dynamics and some of the challenges. This morning's hymn said they were going to bring hope where there wasn't much hope. And I'll do my best to bring some hope, but there's a lot of challenge facing public education. And it was laid out. It is flat out under attack. It is not happenstance. It is a very well thought out, orchestrated, and purposeful movement to eliminate public education in this country. And we happen to be on the leading edge here in Manhattan, in Kansas, thanks to the governor and the legislature that's been elected and the powerful moneyed interests that are behind them. There's essentially three forces at work who are hostile to public education. Most of you probably know these, but one are religious conservatives, starting with debates about teaching evolution to eliminating public prayer in public schools, to allowing gay-straight alliance groups on high school campuses. Many conservative Christians are angry at the curriculums and the policies of public schools. They've pulled their kids out of public schools to put them in parochial schools or to homeschool them. And as such, they're very unhappy about paying for public schools because, one, they're not sending their children there, and, two, they see public schools as promoting an agenda that is anti-Christian, hostile to their beliefs, and therefore they are work actively to undermine public education. A second group that is part of this process can be most easily referred to as the Tea Party, people who are of a very strong anti-tax mentality. Their simple goal is to reduce taxes, reduce government, and the consequences be damned. Shrinking government, in reality, shrinking government, which is their goal, at the state level especially, means shrinking public education. Between pre-K, K-12, and public universities, something like 75% of the state budget goes to education. So if we are shrinking state government, we are by definition shrinking public education. There isn't enough left in that other 25% to do much. So they talk about shrinking government, but in reality what they're talking about is shrinking public education. The third group is not as vocal, not as obvious, but they are powerful and they are moneyed. And probably most of you know the Koch brothers here in the state. And what we're talking about is the Libertarian Party. The party in and of itself is not a particularly powerful group, but there are many powerful, wealthy individuals who align themselves with the Libertarian Party, see themselves as libertarians. The Kochs identify as libertarians. And that's where the money is, and that's where the power is coming from. If you read the Libertarian platform, party platform, it calls for the end of public education. They make no bones about it. It's plain and simple and right there. They believe that education should be the responsibility of the parents, period. Whether you choose to educate your children or not, that's a parental choice. How they are educated, if you so choose to educate them, that is a parental choice, and that's how they see it being done. Of course, they envision parents paying to put their children into some sort of schooling system, but first and foremost, they see it as parental choice, and if parents choose to not educate their children, the libertarians are fine with that. They know that that's not a particularly popular position to take publicly, and so they don't really espouse it, even though it's in their platform, and you can look it up on the internet and see it. It's not something they wave a flag about and trumpet that they want parents to be the sole provider or for their children's education, either directly or financially, but that is the goal. So the libertarians with money are happy to then support the Tea Parties, Tea Party groups, the Tea Party individuals who run for office, and the religious conservatives who run for office. They're happy to use them as their point people. Let them do the dirty work as such of undermining public education in all manner. I subscribe to a number of conservative newsletters online to see what's being said. Some of them are directly about education. Many of them are just about conservative issues in general. A favorite tactic is anytime something goes wrong in a public school someplace, and in particular when a public school teacher does something wrong, then boy, it is trumpeted far and wide. And there are thousands of public schools in this country, and tens of thousands of public school teachers, and tens of thousands of public school employees. and you get that many people together, and there's somebody that's going to be somebody's going to do something stupid. They're going to do something wrong. But highlighting those instances, which is not to let a public teacher off the hook who's done something very wrong, who's violated the trust of a student or a parent, that's not to be excused. But every day in this country, public school teachers are giving children food where they wouldn't have it at home. They're giving children love where they don't have it at home. They're giving them hope where they don't have it at home. They're bringing them knowledge that they would otherwise not get. Thousands and tens of thousands of little miracles are occurring every day in public schools, but one never sees that highlighted. No, we never see something that a public school teacher has done positively highlighted in these conservative blogs, these conservative emails, because they don't want to promote that. They promote the negative, but they will not promote the positive. So that's just one little piece of their strategy. The more insidious strategy is to just simply keep starving public schools for funding. And that's happening, you know, dramatically here in the state of Kansas. What's sort of astounding to me is how they have no bones about lying about what they're doing. We now have, if you haven't, it's obscure, and I understand if you haven't paid attention, but we now have what's called a block grant system for funding schools in the state of Kansas. For the next 2 years, funding for public schools is frozen at the same level that it was this year, essentially. But in the fine print, so on the surface, they can say we're giving as much, and in fact, they say they're giving more money to public schools. But in fact, they're not. The increase that came is through Kansas public retirement employee retirement system money. They are putting more money into CAPERS, and that needs to happen. But that suddenly now is being counted as classroom money. That's part of the money that gets counted as classroom dollars under the Brownback administration's way of thinking and promoting their agenda. But in reality, we will have less money in Manhattan Ogden schools. We're doing a combination of cuts and revenue enhancements to the tune of $3 million. One of the things that's happened to us is we have to put a number of our employees onto our health care system that we haven't had on before. And certainly morally, that's the right thing to do. And I wish financially we could have done that many years ago. But paras and bus drivers and people that haven't had health insurance are now going to have health insurance because we're being forced to by the ACA. It's the right thing to do, but it's going to cost us something to the tune of $1 million. Historically, that is something that the state of Kansas would have stepped up and funded or at least helped with. But because of our governor and our legislators' hostility to the American Health Care Act, they're not going to do that. They are not going to help school systems pay for those additional health care costs. So it's coming out of our existing budget, and that means a cut in other places. We're going to be laying off teachers. We're going to be cutting all sorts of funds. Those of you who have children in the school district will get a whole new round of requests for supplies like reams of paper and boxes of Kleenex and hand sanitizer and all sorts of things that the school ought to be providing, the taxpayers ought to be providing, but we're slowly whittling away at those supplies. It's on one level better to cut supplies than to cut teachers. So I just want it to be very clear that it's not just some passing thing that's going on. Just because we've got some legislators that happen to have gotten elected who are hostile to public education doesn't mean it's going to turn around on a dime. It is not. The libertarians, the people with the money who want to eliminate public education nationwide, are here. They're not going anywhere. They have power. They have wealth. And they're not going to just back down. But they're also not going to be honest about what their goals are, what their methods are, They're going to continue to work passive-aggressively, if you will, to undermine public trust in schools, to undermine funding by making sure that people are elected who are hostile to public education the way that they are. And that's the situation within which we operate. So not a whole lot of hope in that little piece there. One of the key questions is what can we do about it? And that's a very difficult question to answer. Part of why I got involved in public education at the local level is I felt like that's a place that I could make a difference. I don't know that I can make a difference, that I can outweigh the Koch brothers' money or the conservative Republicans' power at the national level or even at the state level. But I can make a difference locally, and I feel like I have. And that's one of the things that everybody in this room can do. You can help our schools here in a bunch of different ways. Sandy highlighted one of them this morning. Absolutely my favorite thing that I've done to help schools is to just go into the classroom and read. Almost any classroom teacher would be happy to have you come read to the kids. Usually I would go read to them right after lunch. They're all amped up between lunch and having run around on the playground. They're all amped up, and I'd come in right after lunch and read to them a little bit, and that gave the teacher some time to sort of get her thoughts together and get ready to go, and I'd read with the kids and get them calmed down a little bit, and I think it was quite helpful because I still get requests to come and do that. If you wanted to do something like that, I would encourage you to pick a school and go talk to the principal and find out where, you know, what room, what teacher, or what program that you could sign up with. I know Lee School has an organized program where seniors go in and read with kids. Some of them work, sometimes you work one-on-one with an individual. In other cases, you go in and read with a group of kids. But it's a great way to help schools, help kids, and actually help yourself, in my opinion. I always feel a little better about myself after I've gone and done that. There are obviously other things that you can do. If you hear somebody saying that the current school funding formula is giving schools more money, gently point out that that's not true. And there's facts to back that up. The deputy commissioner of the State Department of Education has said no single school district in the state is getting more money under the block grant programs. All are taking a hit up to some degree or another. So when they say that schools are getting more money, not less, under the block grant, it's not true. And just you can just gently point that out, that it's just not true. You can support our local educators. One of the great things about Manhattan, sometimes it's a little frustrating, but I can't go bang on somebody's door and say, what are you doing? Our local legislators are doing a great job. They are pro-public education. They are common sense. They are working for the good of our community, for the good of our schools, and they're trying to block the most negative aspects of what's going on in Topeka. But they are massively outgunned, and that takes a very deep personal toll on them on several levels. So one of the best things you could do is to say hi to Sydney or Tom or Tom Phillips, Tom Hawk, Sydney Carlin. Say hi to them. Say thank you so much for what you're doing. Send them a card. Do something for them because they're pretty beat down, on a number of levels. Tom Phillips in particular, as a member of the Republican Party, takes tremendous heat for the positions that he takes in opposition to what Republican leadership wants him to take. But I greatly appreciate Tom, his approach. He's come to the school board members. He's come to our superintendent, Dr. Shannon, and sat down and said, what do you need? Here's what I'm hearing. Is that true? He's a very thoughtful, hardworking individual, and he is under inordinate amounts of stress and attack behind the scenes by the conservatives who do not like him one bit. Sydney and Tom certainly take heat too, but being Democrats, they're just sort of like they don't really count. They just get ignored to a certain extent. Legislative leadership doesn't bang on them to change their votes. But they're still caring people who want to see good things happen, and it's hard on them to go to Topeka day in, day out, and see the damage that's being done to schools and to all sorts of other programs in our state. So give them a pat on the back, give them a hug, send them a card, do something to say thank you for the hard work you're doing, and keep up the good work. Obviously, you know, letters to the editor. If you subscribe to the Mercury, there was a wonderful contributing writer piece a few nights ago where the writer compared what's happening to our public education system to the Dust Bowl. And I thought that was a pretty powerful and apropos image. Write something like that yourself. It can be just something as simple as stand up for public education. It could be highlighting a teacher that you know that's doing good work. Anything that's positive and supportive of our schools would be greatly appreciated, because again, there is a giant machine out there generating lots and lots of publicity about negative publicity about public schools. There is a lot to be proud of about public education in the country, and in our state, and in our community. A lot of the things that we hear about public education failing, how we're 17th or 23rd or 47th or whatever the number is in the world, are hyperinflated, overblown numbers. They're not comparing apples to apples. In the United States of America, in our public schools, we test all kids, no matter what their disability level, no matter if they just arrived here and don't speak English, we test them all. There are certain exceptionalities, but by and large, we test all of our kids. So when you see how many are proficient in reading and math, that's all kids. Many of the countries that we're compared to don't do that. They're skimming off the top. They have a structured education system where certain kids aren't ever expected to go to college. They don't get tested in the same way, and therefore their test scores are not counted. It's just a whole host of reasons. The primary test that gets used to compare schools within the United States and with other countries is called the NAEP, the National Education Achievement. I'm not going to come up with the right word. It's called NAEP. And it's a test that tests students' abilities on math and reading and science and those sorts of things. But it's issued randomly. Not all kids in the state of Kansas take it. A fourth grade class over here in one district, a sixth grade class over here in another district. It's very random. What is on the tests is not shown to anybody. It's, you know, for our state assessments, our teachers know what students are expected to know and learn. For the NAEP, that is not the case. I'll take math as an example. There's a lot of different ways to teach math. And Lily's been took geometry this year, and I thought, well, I'll sit down and refresh myself on geometry. I started out as an engineering student, and I went all the way through differential equations. I sat down and looked at her geometry book, and I couldn't hardly make heads or tails out of it. The verbiage and the wording and the terms have changed completely from when I took math. And so, that verbiage is not standardized across curriculums. It's not standardized across countries. So the verbiage in terms that are used in the NAEP tests are not necessarily the verbiage in the terms that our students learn in their math classes. And so that puts them at a big disadvantage when they take those NAEP tests. Bottom line, in the United States, if you take the most advantaged school districts in the best performing states, say in Massachusetts, they're kicking the tails of a lot of the supposedly high performing countries. Massachusetts students from school districts that aren't impoverished and are high achieving will kick the tails out of the Finnish students or the Singapore students or any number of those high performing students. And if you drill down and you start looking at their performance on certain tests and compare Manhattan, Kansas's performances, we're hanging in there. We're performing in this school district up with some of the highest performing school districts in the country, and that means that we're performing or outperforming some of the pretty much all the countries across the world. But we don't ever hear that. That's never trumpeted and promoted, but it's absolutely true. Our school district recently adopted Singapore math. It's one of the big buzzwords, one of the big, it's really popular now because Singapore students do extremely well on their math tests. So, well, their curriculum, Singapore math must be great. Anybody know much about Singapore? It's a very small country, highly regimented. There's a great article in National Geographic about it. It is pretty much the antithesis of the United States. There is little political dissent. There is little diversity in terms of thought and action. It is a very strictly controlled society. And to say that they're achieving high achievement on math is to be emulated and to adopt their curriculum is to have a complete, in my opinion, misunderstanding of the nature of our society, what works here, what works best for our kids, and it's searching for a magic pill that doesn't exist. Some of you know my wife Sandy's husband, or father, not, you know her husband, I'm her husband, her father, Harry Nelson. Harry is a brilliant mathematician. He edited the Journal of Recreational Mathematics for years, and this is not Sudoku. It's high-level, intense stuff, hardly recreational to most people. He's done extremely high-level computer software work. He's in the Computer Hall of Fame for his computer chess work. Edward Teller, one of the fathers of the H-bomb, showed up at the Lawrence Livermore Radiation Lab one day, which is where Harry worked, and wanted to talk number theory. He wanted to know who the best person in the lab was to talk number theory, and everybody said, well, that's Harry Nelson. So I've talked with Harry on a number of occasions about math curriculums, math teaching, and math learning, and Harry's opinion is, and I highly respect it is not the curriculum, stupid. It's the teacher. And if you want your kids to learn better, help the teachers learn better. Support the teachers, give them professional development, and help the teachers become better teachers of math. It doesn't matter what curriculum you pick. Support the teachers, give them planning time, give them professional development time, make sure they understand math, and then they can help the kids understand math. But again, that's not how we tend to approach it in this country. We're always looking for the magic pill, the new curriculum. We don't want to give our teachers planning time. That costs money. We don't want to give them collaboration time. That costs money. We don't want to give them professional development time. That costs money. We want them to just go in there and magically teach without the necessary support that they need and they deserve and that their kids deserve. And I bring that up because that's one of the things that's on the chopping block, has been on the chopping block in our district. When I got onto the board 12 years ago, our elementary teachers got very little planning time. They got no collaboration time. And they did get some professional development, partly because the state helped pay for that. Over the years, the state has withdrawn professional development funds for teachers. So the district has stepped up and tried to provide that. We're mostly doing it in-house now. We used to bring people in from out of from other districts, from out of state, even from out of country, to work with our teachers and teach them how to teach math and other subjects. Now we pretty much have to do it all in-house. We just have to identify our best and brightest teachers and have them bring along our other teachers with them the best we can. We provide our elementary teachers with a lot more planning time than we used to, but it's still not enough. And we provide them with collaboration time that they didn't used to have. Part of how we've provided planning time for our elementary teachers is we hired, we used to teach Spanish, and when the kids would go to Spanish, then the teachers got some planning time. As budgets got tight and pressures to perform on tests got higher, we abandoned Spanish at the elementary level, and we substituted in math enrichment. And so the kiddos leave the classroom, or they may stay in the classroom. Another teacher teaches additional math time to those students, and then that gives our elementary teachers some planning time. That was one of the big things that was on the chopping block for this go-around. The board and the administration have managed to figure out how to keep math enrichment. We had laid all those teachers off late spring, said we're not hiring you back. Over the summer, we massaged and worked and cajoled and figured out how to keep that money in the budget, and now we're going back out and hiring those math enrichment teachers so that our teachers can keep their planning time, because that's just critical to our students' success, and it's the right thing to do for teachers. But I don't know that we'll be able to do that next year or the year after. It takes money, and we're being choked off on the money side of things for the reasons that have been cited earlier. So again, there are things that can be done, and if you're a person that likes to work on the local level, do something to help out our schools. It can be all sorts of things. Go to the PTO fundraiser and spend a little bit of money, or again, volunteer in the school. There's a number of ways you can help, and that'll make a big difference. And it would be greatly appreciated by a number of people, including me. So I'll stand for a few questions. I appreciate you all being here, and if you've got some questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Yes, sir, Mark.
Thanks a lot, Dave. My question is about how do you answer someone who respectfully says, you know, I just don't want to put my kids in public school. I want to homeschool them, or I want to put them in X private school. I don't see why I have to pay for the public education system. Think about highways. You pay with your gas tax dollars, right? So how do you, what is the solution there? I understand myself why we need public education and that we can't have it, the funding dipping and diving all the time. But how do you answer someone who asks you that question?
That's a great and difficult question. I'll start by pointing out that highways aren't solely paid for by gas taxes. The sales tax in the state of Kansas goes into the KDOT fund, which has now been raided by the governor to fill in the budget gaps. Property taxes at the state, well, not so much the state, but property taxes at the local level go to fix roads too. I'm a bicyclist, if you don't know that, and I get challenged occasionally by cars. I'm out there using the roads, and I'm not paying for them. Well, I pay taxes on four vehicles these days, but I also pay sales taxes, and I pay property taxes, and all of those taxes go to support roads. But back to your real core question. It goes to a real core philosophical part of our country. And it's interesting when you read libertarians thinking on public education, some of their most valued thinkers, Thomas Paine for one, Thomas Paine was a libertarian, yet he supported public schools. And they have a real hard, libertarians have a hard time with that. But, you know, the core thinking behind public schools is that a democracy functions better with an educated populace. And so that's a key concept, is that it's best for all of us if as many and all of our children are educated. And it does benefit all of us. It's not always obvious and direct, but there's a benefit to having the most educated population possible. That is a tough question to answer, because it's hard to draw a straight line from A to B. But another key concept in American life is equality, that we are equal under the law, that we have equal opportunity, and there is no such thing as equal opportunity if schooling is not somewhat equal. And if we do not have public education, high-quality public education for all kids and families who choose public education, then we will not have equality. It's just that simple. So if someone believes in the concept of equality, and if somebody believes in the concept of a quality democracy, those are, I think, the two best reasons to say public education is important. Because without public education, we're going to have large swaths of our population that are educated even less well than they are now, and I think that will be very bad for the country. Does that help a little bit? So another answer is look at countries that don't have good public education and see if you want to be like those countries. That's another key point. None of the countries that we are compared to and supposedly falling behind on the international scale have privatized education. None of them. Finland, Singapore, you name the country that we're being compared to and supposedly falling behind. Those are not private education systems. They are public education systems. There is no model for a high-functioning private education, national private education system in the world to emulate and follow.
With all of this misery, you might say, right-wing behavior, there is a glimmer of something changing. It's not about education, but that will follow. The right-wingers have found out that prisons and hospitals are very expensive. And I heard a news item on television the other day that they were taking the nonviolent drug offenders, the women, and taking them out of prison and putting them into apartments. And they were getting cars, and they were getting, I assume, counseling. They all need counseling, I'm sure. I think we have a shortage of social workers in the country, along with math teachers. And then, also with the homeless, a place like Utah is taking people off the streets. Well, New York has been doing this for years, taking them off the streets and putting them into apartments where they can get to them to help them out. And this, I think, is a major step in this country.
It's interesting that in particular, the libertarians are unhappy about how many people we have in our prisons. And so I think it's always important to find those places of agreement and work there and work together and build trust. And then maybe you can fan out into the areas where you don't agree so much and come to some accommodation and agreement. But you're absolutely right. The prison population in this country is abhorrent. When I was a kid growing up, it was a point of pride how many people were not in prison in the United States, and the Soviet Union was always pointed to as the big bad country because such a high percentage of their population was in prison. Well, guess how that has turned around over the last few decades. It's just incredible. So great point. Thanks. Anne?
I'm interested in the role of the board. It seems to me being on the board is a very time-consuming, difficult, and somewhat thankless job. I don't think you get noticed very often, except when you're making cuts. But are there elections coming up soon that you need to have more candidates? Is that a problem, finding candidates? And does the function of the board depend a lot on who's on the board? Does it sort of the same thing year after year after year?
I'll start with the last. It makes a big difference. When I got on the board, of course, when I got on the board, I got on in part because our student population was declining, therefore our budgets were declining, and whenever you're cutting budgets, things get ugly, they get difficult. It creates tremendous stress on everybody in the system. And when I got on the board, there was a high degree of mistrust. The board was largely dysfunctional. We brought in facilitators from the Kansas Association of School Boards to try to smooth things out. Our board was gaining statewide attention as how not to be, what not to do. And we sent a couple of the Kansas Association of School Board teams packing The board didn't want anything to do with what they had to say or do or try to help us be a little more functional. But over time, things have gotten better, and we've worked hard to build trust amongst ourselves, to build trust with the teachers, to build trust in the community. And I think, you know, the bond issue that was passed a few years ago is a pretty good testament to how far that process has come along. And the recent mail-in vote to allow us to raise the local option budget, I think, is pretty validating on what we've done. But we always need good candidates. And I've gone out and generally a year or so before it's election time, I've started recruiting people to run for the board. This was a tough year for me. My mom passed away from cancer in February. Starting about a year ago, I was pretty invested in trying to help her and spending a lot of time in Kansas City. And suddenly it was time to sign up for the school board, and then it was time to have the election. And we just didn't get out and beat the bushes and get people to sign up. So always, I mean, again, I believe in democracy, and I think there ought to be 15 or 20 people running for the board every time. I understand the reticence. It is time. It is hard work. But it is not thankless. I get a lot of thank yous. I get far more thank yous than I do nasty phone calls and things like that. And I appreciate those thank yous, and that's part of what I said, why I said what I said earlier about thanking Sydney and Tom Carlin and Tom Hawk. Thank yous go a long way. When you're having a tough day cutting budgets, a couple of thank yous really, really makes a big difference. I could liken it to raising kids. Raising kids is about the hardest thing you'll ever do, and generally it's one of the best things you'll ever do, or the best thing you'll ever do. School board work is hard work, but it's some of the best work I've ever done. I'm deeply proud of what I've done personally and what the board has done, and I'm proud of our school system, and that all makes it worthwhile at the end of a long, contentious meeting like we had the other night. Yes, sir.
Just kind of a comparison. Our kids are in Denver Public School System in Colorado, and our page for supplies is 3-4 pages long, from paper towels to tissues, so it's not just here. You know, the list goes on stuff we've got to get.
Colorado passed what's called TABOR, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, some years ago, and the Taxpayer Bill of Rights just completely strangles the legislature's ability to raise taxes, setting very strict limits on what can be done. And I think somehow over the years, I've kind of lost track, I think they've modified that a little bit somehow in Colorado. But it was really onerous at first, and it really tied the hands of local school districts and the state legislature in terms of what they could do. And for a while, TABOR was being floated here in Kansas, but what had happened in Colorado and a couple of other states became known, and TABOR quickly became a bad word. However, we, by all intents and purposes, we now have TABOR in Kansas, because as part of the last-minute budget, it's not even negotiations, the last-minute ramming of the budget down our throats, the legislature has done things where local governments, state, city, and county governments now cannot raise taxes beyond essentially population growth, the consumer price index. There are some exceptions. It's an incredibly poorly written bill. Nobody really knows, but they're working behind the scenes to cap. Of course, public schools school districts are already capped at what they can raise in terms of taxes, but they're working in Topeka to cap what local governments can do in terms of raising taxes, and that's TABOR through the back door. And that's what you get is you get, instead of one page of supplies, you get 3 pages of supplies when your kids enroll in school, and you get, I'm just shocked and embarrassed on one level as a school board member of the check that our constituents have to write when they go enroll their kids. Early enrollment is less than 2 weeks away, by the way. That's how it is. Nebraska has taken a different tack. Nebraska has worked really hard to make free public education indeed be free. The textbook fees and the numerous fees that we have levied against parents in this state and in this district are virtually non-existent in Nebraska. They've said free public education ought to mean that. It should mean kind of, sort of, free. So, appreciate the comment. I don't know what time we're supposed to quit.
One more
question. One more. Hi. It's not really a question. I just wanted to kind of extend a thank you and point out one of the things that I think our district is doing really well with all the cuts is maintaining a library and a library media specialist in each building. There are a lot of districts around the state and around the country that's one of the first things that gets cut back, and it really impacts how those kids in those buildings do, not having that resource available. So, thanks.
One of the big ways that people want to, the anti-public school people want to cut funding is they want to cut librarians because they say they don't impact the classroom. But if you're in a building at all, our librarians teach, and they support our teachers, and they're a critical part of the whole process. And so thank you for recognizing that. Thank you.
Well, as Dave just said, we should thank Sydney and the Toms and folks like Dave. So please join us afterwards out in the Narthex for coffee and conversation, and we will close with the hymn 118, which reflects favorably upon the talk we just had, This Little Light of Mine.